This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We are spending the hour today talking with healthcare providers on the front lines of the coronavirus pandemic. Later this hour, Governor Charlie Baker is scheduled to give his daily briefing, and we'll bring it to you live. For now, this week may be the beginning of a massive surge in cases here in the Commonwealth. To date, 12,500 cases have been reported, and at least 231 people have died. Governor Baker says things will get worse, predicting a peak sometime in the next 2 weeks. And last week, President Trump told Americans, brace yourself.
I want every American to be prepared for the hard days that lie ahead. We're going to go through a very tough 2 weeks.
So this is a critical week for our healthcare providers, and we want to spend this hour checking in with them. How are healthcare workers weathering this storm? How about their families? Are we prepared? Let's begin with some hospital workers who are treating incoming patients. Joining me now is Dr. Willie Baker. Dr. Baker is an emergency medicine physician and vice chair for emergency department quality and safety at Boston Medical Center. He's also clinical associate professor of emergency medicine at Boston University School of Medicine. Dr. Baker, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
Also with us is Dominique Muldoon, a frontline nurse at St. Vincent Hospital in Worcester and co-chair of the local bargaining unit of the Massachusetts Nurses Association at the hospital. Welcome, Dominique.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And you, are you a healthcare or hospital worker? What's happening in your hospital right now? Or do you know a healthcare worker? What are you doing to support them right now? What are you hearing from them? You can call us. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. So, Dr. Baker, Dominique, I want to begin just by asking you, how are you?
I'm good.
What does that mean? Does it mean you're not afraid, Dominique? Does it mean, hey, I am just putting one foot in front of the other? Does it mean I'm charged up and raring to go?
It means I'm putting one foot in front of the other. I'm not sick.
Good.
I'm healthy. I am scared, but that's not going to stop me. I feel very strongly that, you know, it's our job to get people through this crisis.
Thanks for that.
I agree with Dominique. I think that I am kind of good, and I think that most of us reflectively answer that way. I think most of us healthcare workers, especially frontline physicians and nurses, are really, especially emergency medicine physicians and emergency department nurses, really are committed to treating anyone anytime, and this is just one of those extreme yet uncharted territories of what we have always committed to do.
Dominique, you are on a COVID-only floor. Can you tell us about, you know, bring us there with you? What's it like on the floor in Worcester?
So, first of all, before I even go to work, I start getting ready a little bit more than I did before. I pack not only my lunch, I pack an extra set of clothes. I ziplock them in a bag to make sure that they're clean and they go into a gym bag. I pack an extra set of shoes now, all in preparation for when I get to work. And I end the day, I'll have something to change into when I go home. So now I'm like carrying extra bags to work with me. I enter the building where they take our temperature and give us a mask, and then I'm ready to go up to the floor. I get report. I put my N95 mask on. We still have those. We are reusing them, as a lot of healthcare workers in the state are. I know a lot of nurses in other hospitals who are using them, you know, 3 to 5 shifts or even longer.
Without any decontamination of them in between, I'm assuming, Dominique.
Yeah, some of them are not having decontamination. Some, I saw on the news today, they're using a peroxide spray starting this week in Boston. We don't know how effective these masks are going to be each time, but it's what we have, and this is what we're going to wear. I then put on a pair of gloves, a gown, and a face shield and a hat, a bouffant hat, before I see my patients. So I basically, I kind of look like Darth Vader going in to see my patients. But
what an image.
Yes. And so, you know, between, you know, it limits your air. We work in negative pressure. Our whole floor is a negative pressure floor. So it's a little bit warmer and the air is very still. You don't get any kind of a fresh breeze from the air conditioning. And I think we've all adjusted to it, but we move a little bit slower now and a little bit more carefully because of it, it is difficult with everything on to make sure we don't contaminate something or make a mistake while we're so hot and, you know, just trying to do our jobs.
Let's bring Dr. Baker in here on this, Dominique, too. Okay. What is it like? Bring us into the emergency room, Dr. Baker.
Sure. Well, I work at Boston Medical Center, which is the busiest ED in the state. Actually, I think about the eighth busiest in the country.
ED being emergency and department?
Correct.
Okay.
And our overall volume, as is the case in most emergency departments around the country, is down, but our acuity is rather high. And the cognitive load, the tensions, the amount of care involved in taking care of patients with suspected COVID is quite high. As Dominique said, we also have to put on all this protective equipment. The stress of not getting it right, of contaminating oneself, of contaminating another coworker or a staff member, is fairly high. And a lot of our day is spent focused on these things, which we didn't really have to focus on quite as much before.
Let's bring a caller in who I think has a question for the two of you. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. To join the conversation we're having all hour today, checking in on our healthcare workers as the pandemic spreads. We've got Mary Ellen on the line from Leominster. Mary Ellen, did you have a question? Hi, Mary Ellen, are you there? All right, we lost Mary Ellen. She wanted to ask what the two of you think the next 2 weeks are going to look like in your hospitals. Dominique, do you want to go first?
Sure. Right now, we're seeing a gradual increase in the number of patients being admitted. What I think we're going to see is that we're going to become more full with positive and suspected COVID patients. These patients, they can take a turn for the worse very fast on the floors, within hours, have a lot of difficulty breathing and have to go to the ICU. So I think we're going to see more critical patients all over the whole hospital. We're trying to make preparations with getting more ventilators in our hospital. We think we're going to need that. We're trying to do things with high flow oxygen for these patients. But I believe over the next 2 weeks, it's not going to be just a regular hospital. It's going to be like an ICU all over the hospital.
Dr. Baker, I think you were in a meeting earlier today on preparations for BMC. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
So based on what we just heard from Dominique and your meeting, what is the most important need right now?
Well, there are really a number of very important needs. One very important need is adequate PPE, personal protective equipment, for healthcare providers. And those who are watching the news have probably have seen a lot about that. And it's a relevant issue every place. We're very fortunate at Boston Medical Center that for now we have adequate N95 masks and we're not forced to reuse. But we do worry about the future. And we worry about gowns and other aspects of PPE. We also worry about our ability to care for the most critically ill. And that's manifested by the increasing number of patients who require ventilators. There's been a lot in the news about ventilators, and I think with good reason. But what has not been quite as much emphasized in the news is there's a lot more than just the machines, the ventilators. One needs adequate staff for the ventilators, so nurses in particular, who are critical care trained or capable, and as well as doctors who are critical care trained and capable, as well as respiratory therapists. All of these things is really a system for taking care of critically ill patients, not just the ventilators themselves.
So while we have a need for ventilators, even if we, for example, got 1,000 from FEMA as we'd been anticipating rather than the only 100 that we have at this point, there's still the surrounding support structure for that you'd be concerned about.
That's exactly right. And just to give you an example of needs, for several years now, I, along with some of my anesthesia colleagues, have tracked intubations in the hospital. This is the act of putting in a breathing tube, which is associated with putting someone on a ventilator. And we've tracked emergent, that means things that are done emergently, out of the OR, so not elective surgeries that are involved with putting someone on a ventilator, but if somebody is in the hospital and suddenly decompensates and needs to be put on a ventilator, or someone comes into the emergency room and needs to be put on a ventilator. So we've tracked these numbers. And on average, our baseline is on an average day, we put 2.7 patients a day on a ventilator, either us or the anesthesiologist in the emergency department or upstairs. Since our COVID pandemic has hit Boston, that number has jumped to an average of 9.7 per day.
Okay. Yeah, that's a big change. So I'd like to ask you one other quick question, Dr. Baker, and then I'm going to go back to Dominique. Dr. Joseph Betancourt, the Chief Equity and Inclusion Officer I've lost his hospital here, I apologize for that, told WBUR reporter Simone Rios that they are seeing upward of 35% to 40% of COVID patients who are Latino. So 35% to 40% of their admitted COVID patients are Latino at that hospital, compared to normal inpatient levels of 9% Latino population. Do you have any early observations at Boston Medical Center that are consistent with that or different?
I really can't give you an accurate number. I don't have data on that. Boston Medical Center serves a predominantly underserved community. About a third of our patients speak a language other than English as their primary language. And in a range of 70% or more are supported by some form of government health insurance. And those demographics are rather different than some other hospitals in the state. And my general gestalt is that's who I'm seeing as COVID patients. But I can't tell you there any higher percentage of Hispanics represented amongst them.
Okay. Let's take another call that I want to then turn to Dominique on. We've got Susan on the line from Jamaica Plains. Susan, go ahead.
Oh, hi. Yes, my name's Susan. And I have a question about, I've been hearing that the nurses in the ICU, the COVID-positive patients, that the nurses are entering the room only, and everyone else, the doctors, are not. Is that? And I'm hearing there might be staffing issues, like
yeah.
Okay,
not enough respiratory therapists and nurses.
Great question.
And then one
Susan.
More.
Oh yeah, go ahead.
One more is, and what is the ratio of patient to nurses in the ICU right now?
Great questions, Dominique. What can you help us with there?
So I think that the nurses are going into the patients more. The doctors are going in, but there is a concerted effort to conserve PPE. So the more people going into the room, dietary, PT, MDs, everybody, it uses up the gowns, the masks, the gloves, everything. And we're so short right now that we are trying to limit that. And oftentimes the nurse in the ICU will stay in that room for several hours. And, you know, we'll have runners to help her outside the room to get what she needs, he or she needs. And that is a big part of why that happens. And I'm sorry, I forgot the second half of that question.
It's just what are the staffing ratios, and are you concerned about not being able to maintain the appropriate ratios?
I am concerned about it. Right now at our hospital, it's 1 to 2, but the mandatory ICU law has been negated because of the emergency, and we understand that. But as we get into this crisis with more and more patients coming in, I am afraid that the nurses will be taking more patients.
Let's try to... I'm sorry, Dominique. I want you to go ahead and finish. I just didn't realize you were done. Please go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying I'm just concerned about with the influx of patients that we're not going to have enough ICU nurses. There will be, you know, they will have to take more patients than is really safe to do so.
I'd like to try to take just one more call. We've got Tim on the line from Brighton. Tim, go ahead.
Hello there. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say, as a member of the Boston Emergency Medical Services, we're very well treated, but EMS on a whole across the country doesn't receive the equality of, let's say, police or fire. And I know we're all struggling so much, and now's not the time for this kind of conversation, but I hope when this is all done, that we'll be able to look back and hopefully make EMS more on par with police and fire as far as resources so that we can be ready for these types of events when they happen. Thank you so much.
Thanks for making that call, Tim. I appreciate it. And in our last just few seconds, Dr. Baker, do you have anything you want to react to with Tim's call?
Well, I think the EMS providers are on the front line. And a call comes in, there's a paucity, a very little information provided. And they show up and they're in the back of an ambulance in an enclosed area with a patient that may be shedding quite a bit of COVID virus. Not all of these cases come in as obvious respiratory illness. People call up with asthma. And sure, that's respiratory. They're faced with some tough decisions. They have to stop treating as usual. People get called in as just having chest pain, and we're finding that some of them have COVID. So the EMS providers are very much put at risk. I agree with them.
All right. Well, we appreciate you joining us today. That's Dr. Willie Baker, an emergency medicine physician and vice chair for Emergency Department Quality and Safety at Boston Medical Center. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And Dominique Muldoon, a frontline nurse at St. Vincent Hospital in Worcester and co-chair of the local bargaining unit of the Massachusetts Nurses Association at the hospital. Dominique, be safe. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having and thank you for listening.
And just a quick note that Dr. Joseph Betancourt, who I referred to earlier in the segment, is from Massachusetts General Hospital. All this hour, we are talking about how the coronavirus pandemic is affecting healthcare workers and the healthcare industry itself. Are we prepared for the moment? And how do we take care of the people working on the medical front lines, especially when they're worried about bringing the virus home to their own loved ones? That's what we want to focus on now. And we invite you, pull up a chair. Is your loved one or someone you live with working on the front lines of this pandemic? What's your experience been like? What precautions are you taking? What are your biggest worries and concerns as the state and the nation prepare for a surge in cases in these next couple of weeks? You can call us and share your thoughts at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or tweet us at Radio Boston. Joining us now to talk about their own experiences are Josh and Deb Merson. Josh Merson is an emergency medicine physician assistant at Brigham and Women's Hospital and the associate program director of PA studies at the MGH Institute. Josh, welcome.
Hi, how are you today?
Good, thanks. Now, while Josh is at work, his wife, Deb Merson, is home caring for their 18-month-old son, Dalton. Deb has asthma and an autoimmune disease, so the Mersons are especially worried about any of them getting infected. Deb, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And again, call, join the conversation with Josh, Deb, me about the experiences you or your loved ones are having as healthcare workers in this moment. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I just want to check in first, Josh and Deb. How are you? How's it been going?
Doing pretty well right now. It's been busy, hectic at times, but we're doing well.
Deb, how about you?
We are both well, Dalton, myself, and Josh, and we are just so fortunate that we are healthy at this time.
And how have things changed at home, Deb, since the pandemic spread began? What adjustments have you had to make?
Well, I have stopped going to work. I was a figure skating coach, and our rinks have been shut down. So I am home full time with Dalton. And we are not going to any sort of activities. Our early intervention, instead of having somebody come to the house for him, we are doing weekly Zoom meetings with them.
Josh, how has home changed for you?
So much of it, I'm still working. When I'm teaching, thankfully I'm able to do most things by Zoom, but when I'm coming home from the emergency departments, there is that fear aspect to it. Before I would come home, jump in the shower, not be too worried. But since this all started in the last few weeks, I've really worked hard to, I guess, try to decontaminate myself as much as possible and try to do as much as I can to keep everyone else healthy at home.
Josh and Deb, my husband is a psychiatrist, works at a psychiatric hospital. Our kids are older than Dalton, significantly older than Dalton. But just the pure logistics of thinking every day about the two of us coming home and how we try to keep from bringing a virus into the house and then sort of create some semblance of normalcy inside the house before you go back out every day. Can you kind of explain the challenges of that and what you're doing to try to maintain some normalcy?
Yeah, so we're lucky that Dalton is actually only 18 months old. So for him, he really doesn't know much of a difference. But the big thing is the first thing we do when we come into our house is we take off our shoes and our jacket, and they get put into one very specific place so that we don't have to touch them. And we go to our entry floor bathroom and we wash our hands. And having that just be the first thing we do helps us just make sure that once we're in our house, we are clean.
Josh, what about you? I mean, it must be a massive task.
Yeah, as much as I can, I want everything to be as normal as possible. Thankfully, as Deb said, him being 18 months, we do have some leeway. We don't have to worry about a lot of friend groups. Coming home just as much as I can before I ever interact with Deborah Dalton, I am watching every single step that I take. I'm taking all my clothes off, my shoes, before I ever enter the house, and really throwing all my clothes directly into the washer, going directly in the shower before I ever interact with Dalton or my wife, just to be sure that there is no contamination of anything else in the house, or I don't have Dalton coming yelling and saying, "Hi, Dada," just jump in my arms.
Yeah, yeah. Let's take a couple of calls. We have people who want to talk with you. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Kristen's on the line from Roslindale. How are you, Kristen?
Hey, I'm good. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. What's on your mind today?
You know, I don't have a question. I'm really just calling with an appreciation call for all of you. You for your fantastic reporting. I have been tuning in and learning, honestly, so much from your show. I don't tune in every single day, but I try to. And for the gentleman who's on the line right now, you know, just a big thank you to all the healthcare workers out there. I feel really lucky that I'm a teacher and, you know, I'm still getting paid, but I don't need to be out there on the front line. So anyway, it was really just a thank you call.
Thanks, Kristen. That's wonderful. And Josh, are you hearing thank yous from people like Kristen, that kind of generosity, and what does it mean for you?
It's been so overwhelming for me, and I think a lot of the other PAs and other healthcare providers that I work with, we feel so supported. There's an amazing organization that's been trying to get restaurant workers back to work and actually donating food to all of us. But I'll be honest, we feel bad it so often. This is our job. This is really our calling and what we want to do. And although we feel really supported, we, at least my personal opinion is that we want to support all the small local businesses as much as we can as well. So it's whenever we have the opportunity to support others, I hope that we are all able to do that.
Let's take another call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have another Kristen from Jamaica Plain. Kristen, how are you?
I'm great. I just wanted to offer a perspective from our family.
Please do.
My husband, he's a registered nurse at an acute care facility in Dorchester, and he did have some exposure last week without the proper PPE, and so we had to quarantine him in our bedroom in our small JP apartment. And unfortunately, he did test positive on Friday, and we have two children, and we're trying to quarantine, and I've tested negative so far. So I guess one thing I want your callers to understand is that he never had the classic fever that many hospitals and nursing homes are using as kind of the bellwether indicator of COVID. So I guess that is really keeping me up at night, thinking that a lot of our service providers probably don't even know they have it yet, and they're getting let onto their shift.
Kristen, I'm so sorry that this has happened. And before we let you go, I just want to ask, are you okay? You doing all right?
Yeah, we're doing good. My husband is doing well, and fortunately, he says it's very similar to a cold, and is in good spirits and good appetite. And we have these virtual family dinners where we set up Zoom and we put the iPad in his chair. So everyone is in good spirits, and you know, thankfully, he is handling it pretty well. And you know, we just are thinking of all the caregivers who are not as lucky as we are, and all the patients who aren't as lucky as we are.
Well, Kristen, our thoughts are with you and your husband and your kids. Deb, let me turn to you and just ask you, you know, as someone who's also worried about a spouse, you know, worried about your child at home, what do you think about when you hear a call like Kristen's?
It's always going to be scary. That's one thing, being married to somebody who is out there being exposed, when I have, you know, my own personal fears, and yet I hear from my friends who are afraid about going to the grocery store because they might get it. And I know that our risk is a lot higher than others. However, I would much rather Josh be able to go and help where he can than keep him locked in a box. So it is a risk, but we just try to do everything that we can to protect our house as a whole.
And we've made the co-decision not to, I guess, completely self-isolate or self-quarantine myself in the basements, and still trying to interact as a family, and then doing as much as I can to have that decontamination when I do get home.
What?
And hopefully,
I'd love to ask the two of you, Josh, you were just very clear that you guys have made that decision together. What was behind that decision? Why is that the right one for your family and your relationship?
I think much more of it was the support we could have as a family together versus being isolated. I want, you know, to, let's say this is going to be 2 months long, having 2 months with Josh not interacting with our son, it's a long period of time, and he would be missing a lot. And I don't think our spirits would be quite as high if we weren't having a family, you know, family dinners, and, you know, being able to sit down and sing along together.
I'd love to get one more caller voice in with the two of you. We've got Dave on the line from Bellingham. Hi, Dave.
Hi, how are you today?
Thanks for asking. Well, thanks. How about you?
Good. Yeah, doing okay. I don't have any complaints.
Good. What's on your mind?
Well, I was just calling because I have quite a family of people in the medical field, and you know, they're all out there doing their thing and working the front lines. And you know, for Josh and all the others involved, you know, I just really feel proud that they're sticking it out. And you know, I think that in the context of this whole thing, you know, you can look back to Winston Churchill's time during the Battle of Britain, and you know, say once again, maybe I'm not going to quote it perfectly, but you know, that never before in history has so much been owed to so few by so many. So that's kind of where I'm feeling.
Thank you, Dave. That's fabulous. I have to admit, Josh and Deb, I got a little choked up listening to Dave's pride in the two of you for the commitment that you're making for Josh to do his work.
Yeah, well, I really am.
I'm sorry. Say that again.
No, I'm proud of all of them. I mean, I'm proud of my daughter, my son, my daughter-in-law, two daughter-in-laws. They're all in the medical field. And they're all sticking it out and doing everything that they can. And even with the circumstances being what they are, you know, they're just, you know, I think everybody that's not complaining, everybody that's not bailing out is going to be proud at one point that they did stick it out.
Thanks so much for that. Josh and Deb, as we close here, let me ask you, just what's your message to the broader community, to our listeners who are thinking about you and listening to you today?
I think the biggest thing for me is, I know this has been a very common message, is that we are all in this together. It's not just one person. It's not just a small group of people. It's everyone doing their parts. I think I saw something on Facebook a while ago that all these healthcare providers are not the front lines, but we're the last line of defense, really doing everything we can to keep people safe. And it requires everyone else being, maintaining that self-isolation and trying to actually prevent others from being sick. And I think that's probably the most important thing, that we are all one big family.
And Deb, how about you?
I think the biggest thing for me would just be that for everyone to look at their community as a whole, their friends, their neighbors, their local businesses, and just help out anywhere they can. So before Josh will go to the store, we will ask a neighbor if they need us to pick them up anything. And just all those little things, I think they can have a huge impact.
That's Josh and Deb Merson, who together are ensuring that Josh can do his work as an emergency medicine physician assistant in Brigham and Women's Hospital. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Governor Charlie Baker is expected to hold his daily briefing soon. When he does, we will bring it to you live. In the meantime, all this hour, we have been talking with people working on the medical front lines of the coronavirus. With the worst weeks likely upon us here in the Commonwealth, we're fortunate to have some of the best hospitals in the world preparing to care for those who get sick. So we want to use this time to take stock. How ready are our hospitals, our facilities, the Commonwealth itself, our workers? Joining us to talk about it is Dr. Peter Slavin, president of Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Slavin, welcome.
Thank you.
How are you?
Okay. We're hanging in there.
How about MGH? How's it doing?
I've been associated with this hospital for 35 years when I first came there as a resident, and I've never been more proud of the place than I have been over the last few weeks. The spirit, the determination of the staff to do everything they possibly can to care for our growing number of patients has just been extraordinary. Their flexibility, innovation has also been mind-boggling, so it's really an extraordinary thing to watch.
It's inspiring to hear, too. I want to ask you, the Inspector General of Health and Human Services released a report today finding that hospitals around the country continue to confront severe shortages in testing and in personal protective equipment. I want to ask, what is the status at MGH, both on PPE and ability to do quick and effective testing?
I think we're, at the moment, in pretty good shape on both. As far as PPE goes, I mean, certainly we were thrilled, as were healthcare workers across the Commonwealth, when our board chair, Jonathan Kraft, working with the governor, pulled off that amazing journey from China with over a million N95 masks. And that is, in round numbers, probably about a month's supply of the entire state of Massachusetts. So those are going to be a big help. And the other thing that's going on with PPE, the same masks, is this facility that we're in the process of installing in Somerville, a facility manufactured by a company called Battelle that has the potential to reprocess, decontaminate 80,000 N95 masks a day. And that facility will be available to all hospitals in the state, maybe more broadly, and should be up and running by the end of this week.
I wanted to ask you about that, Dr. Slavin, specifically the million masks. When Governor Baker last week announced that, he referred to it as a private humanitarian mission. And I guess the question that comes up is, does that mean things are working because we were able to achieve a private humanitarian mission that brought a million N95 masks to the Commonwealth? Or does that mean that something's not working because we needed a private humanitarian mission to bring a million N95 masks to the Commonwealth?
Well, I guess what is working in this case, I mean, is the incredible determination, dedication of the governor and the Kraft family to make this possible. And it will do wonders for the healthcare workforce in this state, and it certainly has buoyed their spirits. It's unfortunate that it needed to happen in the first place. The distribution of supplies at this point should be tightly managed by the federal government, and using the Defense Production Act should be not only making sure that all industries are producing as many of these supplies as possible, but playing an active role in distributing them nationwide where they're needed the most. And I think the efforts from our federal government have been less than what our country deserves.
I want to ask you about that, too, that we've been hearing and having conversations on this show for a few weeks now about the Defense Production Act. And sometimes when I get someone with a very unique perspective, I just want to ask them, how big of a deal is it? And so how big of a deal is it for the federal government to really move with the Defense Production Act and put it in place to create more supplies and equipment here in the United States?
Yeah, well, I co-authored an op-ed piece with Senator Markey on this topic a few weeks ago. It appeared in the Globe, calling for the president to invoke the Defense Production Act. And Senator Markey spoke to the vice president that night, and in fact, the president did sign it the next day. But they didn't really utilize it until very recently, which I think is unfortunate. A lot of time was wasted along the way, time when a lot more masks, ventilators, and other supplies could have been produced. It gives the federal government enormous authority to direct industry to do things that are maybe out of their comfort zone, but that's exactly what happened during World War II when President Roosevelt created the War Production Board and had typewriter companies make machine guns, had underwear companies make parachutes. That's what we need our federal government to do in these kind of circumstances.
The other thing that, of course, has come up over the last day, last week or late the week before, Governor Baker had announced that we were anticipating 1,000 of the ventilators that the Commonwealth had requested from the federal government. We heard yesterday that the state received, or Governor Baker said that yesterday the state received a shipment of 100. And it doesn't necessarily seem clear that the rest, the other 900, are coming quickly. What kind of reaction should our broader healthcare community have to that news, and how much risk does that create that we only got a fraction of what we were anticipating, and that we were anticipating less than we asked for?
Mm-hmm. I just don't think that there are that many ventilators out there to be distributed. My understanding is this federal stockpile had maybe 20 or 30,000, and the state of New York has called for a number more than that. So I just don't think there's the inventory out there to satisfy all the needs of the state. And producing these ventilators take time, which is why it's disappointing that as far as ventilators go, I think the president just started using the Defense Production Act within the last 2 days. If he had done it a couple of weeks ago, or if he had done it months ago, we might be in a very different position.
So I can hear listeners out there sort of yelling at the radio saying, we are maybe the medical hub of the country. We are a healthcare-rich environment. How do we find ourselves in a situation where we are not able, we don't have what we need? We're worried about shortages of personal protective equipment. We don't have the number of ventilators that we're deeply concerned this surge is going to create a need for. How do we answer that question for ourselves?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think it's premature to know whether we're going to have what we need or not. The hospitals, under the leadership of the governor and the state, are working very collaboratively with one another, and we're, for example, in the city of Boston, making sure that patients are going or being transferred to the hospitals that have the most capacity. So
you think it's possible that we've created a network and a set of capacities that could absorb what's coming for us?
That is certainly my hope. I think it would be unfortunate, particularly when it comes to ventilators, if we ran short and had to make some very difficult life and death decisions. It's certainly my hope, and looking at the data every day or twice a day, I think there's a decent chance that we will be able to meet the demand, but it's not certain.
What's the capacity of the ICU at Mass General right now?
We generally operate about 150 ICU beds under normal circumstances. We are now running more than that. And we have the capacity to go up to as many as 300. And the capacity is limited by the number of ventilators we can get our hands on, but also the space that would be appropriate to support ICU-level care, as well as the staff that is expert in ICU care. Right now, as of this morning, we had about 100 patients in the intensive care unit with COVID-19 or who were suspected of COVID-19. And so we still have some opportunities to accommodate more, and we're just counting the days between now and the peak and hope that the capacity is sufficient.
Dr. Slavin, we've had the warning that pretty soon Governor Baker will begin his daily press briefing, and when he does, we'll carry it live. So
sure.
I both want to thank you in advance so that I'm not rude when we go to that live.
No worries.
But also in our last minute or so, what is your message to the broader community right now as we prepare for what we anticipate will be a spike?
Well, I guess I'm biased. I do think we have the best medical community in the country and the world here in Boston and across the state. We've been preparing for emergencies, crises, disasters for years, dating back to the Coconut Grove fire through World War II, Spanish flu, and most recently the Boston Marathon. I think at times like this, the Boston medical community, when chips are down, really responds brilliantly, and the response that's going on now at Mass General and hospitals throughout this region is inspirational, and I think the people of this region should take a lot of comfort from that.
And as we continue to wait for the governor, I know he'll be on air momentarily. I do want to ask you. Oh, there we go. Thank you, Dr. Slavin.
All right, thank you. Have a good day.
So we're bringing you a live feed of Governor Charlie Baker on a coronavirus briefing at Eastern Bank.
He's about to announce a COVID-19 relief fund. Here he is.
Update on just some news with respect to COVID-19. There are 100 ventilators that we received from the national stockpile, and those are being sent out to community hospitals and academic medical centers starting today. The distribution will be based on guidance that the command center got from its medical advisory group, and in this particular case, that was led by Paul Bittinger from Mass General. Based on today's testing results, we've now tested about 76,500 people in Massachusetts, and 13,837 have tested positive. Tomorrow, we'll announce a new site in Lowell in partnership with CVS that will conduct up to 1,000 tests a day. That will be done probably on an appointment basis, and we'll work through a variety of communities, such as first responders and others in public safety, who we've tried to make these drive-through test sites available to in other parts of Massachusetts. There's another one that will be going up probably later this week at the Big E in West Springfield. Obviously, without question, this public health crisis continues to be one of the most challenging events we in the Commonwealth have ever faced. And I want you to know that I spoke many times yesterday with Boston Mayor Marty Walsh about everything he's doing to slow the spread of COVID-19 in Boston. I believe he's doing a terrific job. We spend a lot of time talking to each other. Many people who work on his staff spend a lot of time talking to people working on my staff, and we fully support the initiatives and the policies that he is pursuing for the city of Boston. I think in many respects the overarching message that comes from many of the announcements that he made yesterday is a really simple one. If you don't have to leave home, don't. If you need to go to the store, if you need to shop at the supermarket, one person should be able to make that trip. If you need to go for a walk, by all means, go for a walk. But we're not supposed to be gathering in groups. That's been made very clear now for several weeks here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. We are not supposed to be playing active outdoor sports with each other. And many of the initiatives that have been pursued by many of my colleagues in local government have been in direct response to the small portion of people in their community who aren't following the guidelines that everybody else seems to have been able to adopt. And this is especially true now more than ever as we head into what we all believe is going to be a particularly difficult period for many of our healthcare providers and many of our constituents. And I can't express how important it is that people take this stuff seriously and take it to heart. I talked several weeks ago about the purpose that's associated with all this. Many people had talked to me about the fact that as they no longer could go here or go there or do this or do that, they felt they had lost a significant part of their purpose. And what I would say to all those people is something I've said before, that there is tremendous purpose in all the issues associated with social distancing, and all the issues associated with hygiene, and all the issues associated with disinfecting and wiping down surfaces. Because with a virus like this one, that's as contagious as this one, and in many cases, as invisible as this one can be, the most important and purposeful thing we can all do is abide by those rules and engage them in a serious way. No one really knows how many people will be lost to this virus. But if you just follow the conversation that's taking place between public health officials, healthcare officials generally, and public health experts, the numbers are extraordinary. And as I've said before, behind every one of those numbers is a person with a story and a family and a circle of friends. And we should be doing everything we can as individuals and as communities at this point to recognize, appreciate, and understand the value and the importance of social distancing, the value and the importance of staying at home, and the value and the importance of recognizing and understanding that the best and most purposeful way to fight the virus is to not spread it to others and to give our healthcare community the opportunity that it needs to create capacity to deal with the surge and to ensure that we do everything we can here in Massachusetts to help people make their way through this. And I don't think I need to say to anybody here or anybody who might be watching that there are terrific stories of resiliency and grace that go on throughout the Commonwealth. Whether you're talking about the folks in our healthcare community, our emergency responder community, our public safety community, our transportation and public transportation and transit community, or the folks who load the shelves and provide services and support to you when you go to the grocery store or answer questions for you when you go to the pharmacy. Here in Massachusetts, we also have some of the most important players in the mad race to enhance and improve the quality, sophistication, and speed of testing, as well as deep research into possible treatments and potentially down the road, even vaccines to deal with this. All of those people are engaged in the same kind of purpose that we would hope and expect everyone in Massachusetts in their own way can engage in themselves. And that's part of what today's about. We're here to talk a little bit about the establishment of the Massachusetts COVID-19 Relief Fund. My wife, First Lady Lauren Baker, is here with me today, along with our friend Joanna Jacobson, who's been involved in putting this together as well. And the goal here is simple, which is to create a statewide fund that can support many of the local foundations and community assets that have been serving communities and people here in Massachusetts for years and years and years, to help those who are going to have the hardest time working through and dealing with all of the economic consequence and public health consequence that's associated with this particular virus make their way through. It's launched with a $1.8 million anchor donation from Massachusetts' own 1-8 Foundation, and it's joined by several other amazing philanthropists, and will start with more than $13 million available to distribute. I do want to give a shout out to Bob Rivers and the folks at Eastern Bank. The relief fund will be powered by Eastern Bank to be a critical conduit to direct resources, as I mentioned before. They can put resources in the hands of many of the nonprofits who know these communities best and will be most able to provide people in those communities with the support that they need across the Commonwealth. The Foundation for Business Equity and the Boston Foundation will be the fiscal sponsors for the fund, and we're extremely grateful to have their support. Lauren will talk more about the fund, but I do want to say how grateful I am to the 1-8 Foundation and all the other philanthropists and leaders here in the Commonwealth who have already stepped up and contributed, and to the folks at Eastern Bank, not just for their leadership on this particular initiative, but on so many other community-based opportunities that they have pursued over the course of many years. And if you have the opportunity to support this particular organization, as you think about the people here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts for whom this particular period of time is going to be most rough, I hope you'll consider donating to the fund as well. With that, I'll turn it over to Lauren.
Thank you. Good afternoon. There are a lot of communities across Massachusetts where, even in the best of times, people struggle. And these are communities where families live paycheck to paycheck, and they've been particularly hard hit by this COVID-19 health crisis. We founded the Massachusetts COVID-19 Relief Fund to help people in every corner of this Commonwealth access the resources that they need. This fund is going to support essential frontline workers and other vulnerable communities who face issues like food and housing insecurity and the loss of critical services. The Massachusetts COVID-19 Relief Fund will partner with a network of excellent community foundations and local nonprofits who have deep roots in their communities and boots on the ground to deploy these funds quickly and effectively. We're really grateful in particular to the 1-8 Foundation for conceptualizing this fund and doing a lot of the groundwork that needed to be done to bring it to life, and for their incredibly generous lead gift of $1.8 million. And to Eastern Bank for really helping to bring this fund to life. They've generously offered to administer the fund at no cost, which, if you're familiar with Eastern Bank, it's perfectly in keeping with their long tradition of giving back to our communities. And to the Foundation for Business Equity and the Boston Foundation, thank you for agreeing to be fiscal sponsors for this fund, and to Mintz Levin for invaluable advice and counsel. Most importantly, we have to thank our generous donors who, through their generosity, have made it possible for this fund to launch with $13 million available to people in need. The people of Massachusetts always step up. We're resilient, we're compassionate, and strong. We have proven time and again that we will work together, support each other, and do whatever it takes to overcome any challenge. Well, the COVID-19 crisis is probably the biggest challenge any of us have faced. But I know that the people of Massachusetts are going to work together and support each other and do their part to help their neighbors survive and succeed. And I know that if we all work together, we're going to make it through this just fine. So I hope that everyone will take a minute to go to macovid19relieffund.org to learn more and make a donation. Every donation counts, whether it's $5 or $50 or $5 million. Every dollar will go to serve people in need in every corner of Massachusetts. With your help and generosity, we can weather this storm and come through it stronger together. Thank you. Please visit MassCOVID19ReliefFund.org. And now I'd like to turn it over to Joanna Jacobson from the 1-8 Foundation.
So just as the governor said, it's time for all of us to do our best, and by doing our best, that's our purpose. We are so lucky to live in a state where people step up time and time again. The generosity of the donors who have already given has been overwhelming, and we invite all the corporations, leaders, other philanthropists and donors, and all the individuals. We know how hard it is for everyone who's at home, who wants to help, but they can't leave their homes to help. Your donation will make a difference no matter how much it is. And we look forward to establishing this fund and working in direct collaboration with local community foundations so that we can drive the dollars to existing nonprofits who serve people best. We are fortunate to have a state filled with a lot of people who want to help. I think that in many times we think about our neighborhoods in small areas. This is the time to think about the entire state, to think about our neighbors across the state, Fall River, New Bedford, Holyoke, Springfield, Worcester, Lawrence, Lowell, Chelsea, all over. We need to help. We need to be there for everybody. And I join the First Lady, who it's been an honor to work with, to say that this $13 million is only a small beginning to a fund that can really help make a difference. It will not be the magic answer to everything, but if we do this well, if we do this together, we can have an impact. And I'd like to pass it over to Bob Rivers at Eastern Bank.
Well, good afternoon. First of all, I want to thank both the governor and the First Lady for the kind words about Eastern. Governor, I have to tell you, thank you so much for your leadership, particularly during these extraordinary times. That comes not only from me, but it comes from my mom, who was in tears last night telling me how thankful she is to you for everything you've done. Really special thanks to our First Lady for all the work, the positive energy, spirit that you bring to bringing this to life and making this happen. Thank you. Thank you so much for your leadership. Thanks also to the 1-8 Foundation for your lead donation and to Johanna for your vision and your efforts in bringing so many of us together in our philanthropic community to get us started with such an incredible initial collective commitment. Thank you. At Eastern, we're very thankful to be in a position to help and really honored to be asked. In addition to making a financial contribution from the Eastern Bank Charitable Foundation, we are helping in ways that we best can by providing our technical, banking, and administrative services to enable people to make donations in a safe, easy, and reliable way. I'm grateful to our partners at the Foundation for Business Equity and at Pinkaloo, led by the President and CEO of the Eastern Bank Charitable Foundation, Nancy Steger. We recognize that this is bigger than any of us alone, and I am so thankful for your teamwork and your fast response. Once again, endless thanks to our Governor and our First Lady, and for all those involved in this fund, for what you are doing in providing a way for all of us across the Commonwealth to be involved in the relief efforts.
Lauren, why don't you see if people have questions specifically on this?
Does anybody have questions on the Massachusetts COVID-19 Relief Fund?
Lauren, do you guys have a goal for what you hope to raise over time or through the pandemic or
Well, I think it's fair to say that we have no idea where this is going to go, but that we know that the need will be incredible. So we're incredibly grateful to be able to launch this fund with $13 million, and I think the sky is the limit for how much we would like to raise. The more money we can raise, the more money we can push out into communities where there is significant need and make life better for people. Anything else?
This is WBUR. I'm Tiziana Deering of Radio Boston, and you've been listening to live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker, First Lady Lauren Baker, and others announcing at Eastern Bank today a mass COVID-19 relief fund of beginning at $13 million to provide support to needy individuals, first responders. Steve Brown of WBUR was listening along with us and joins us now. Steve, how are you?
I'm doing fine, Tiziana.
Steve, was this an anticipated announcement?
Yes. Actually, they were going to make this announcement on Friday. It was scheduled for Friday afternoon after the governor's daily briefing. Sometimes they don't have a daily briefing. They'll have an event like this instead, which the governor will oftentimes take some questions off topic regarding the coronavirus. So this was supposed to be on Friday, but they pushed it off to today. Basically, they're setting up a coronavirus COVID-19 relief fund for Massachusetts. They've got $13 million available to distribute. Eastern Bank will be distributing that. The goal is to help, support foundations to help those who will have the hardest time due to the economic impact of the coronavirus and COVID-19.
And Steve, it doesn't appear that the funds would go directly to individuals from the core fund. It looks like they'll work through local nonprofit organizations, community foundations, et cetera.
Yeah, that's pretty much the way it'll be working. They'll be going through the different organizations that are on the ground in the various communities all around the state, from Provincetown all the way out to Pittsfield and every place in between. Because, those are the groups and the foundations that work day in and day out in those communities. They know how to contact, get in touch with those people that are in need and make sure that the resources get to them.
So that we've been covering Governor Baker's daily press briefings for a while now. This is the first time we've seen First Lady Lauren Baker on stage. What do you make of that?
Well, yeah, this is something that I guess, he's putting her in charge of the more of the philanthropy side of this. What we've been seeing over the last several weeks are the nuts and bolts technical way of running the state and making sure that the medical community has the resources it needs and just the day-to-day operations, getting people to buy into social distancing and staying at home and halting the spread of the coronavirus. Now they're looking kind of beyond that and know that they're going to need the resources to do that. And so now it's the philanthropy that's stepping up. And so Mrs. Baker's going to be kind of in charge of this particular aspect of it.
Steve, in our last 30 seconds or so prior to the announcement about the relief fund, Governor Baker made a lot of comments encouraging people of the Commonwealth to practice the kinds of social distancing guidelines that he's put in place. He even sounded a bit exasperated. Any comments about that?
Yeah, you're going to hear much more of that as we go along. We've been kind of in this and we all lose track of how many days this has been going on. It's about 3 weeks that we've been doing this and probably another 4 weeks ahead. So there's going to be, I think, a temptation of people going, okay, I've been cooped up enough. I've got cabin fever. I've got to go see my friends.
Well, Steve, I got to take it back from you there. I'm so sorry. Thanks for joining us today for this live coverage. We're going to return now to All Things Considered here on WBUR. I'm Tiziana Deering.